Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Adam Barrett.
Hey, Adam. I just saw your video you posted the other day on your event you did. It was like a one-day seminar, and you had some guest speakers. And I think by the time this episode comes out, you'll have, I think, three or four more videos of presentations posted so people could still attend. I think that's the cool part of it. But so how'd it go? How did it? I'm really curious, though, is what did you break?
Oh, yes, yes. I know that's my favorite personality trait that you like.
Oh, yeah.
Is what I break.
That's right.
Which I found the right career, obviously.
That's right.
It was amazing. It's so funny how this little conferencing started like years ago. It all started because a gentleman from Qualmark, who's a friend of mine, once was like, hey, you and Brian, who owns New England Halt Labs here, who Brian and I have been friends for decades, he's like, you guys should just like invite customers over and just like do a talk or something or whatever. And I was like, yeah, it's a pretty good idea. Why not? You know, just someday we'll go to the lab and invite local people who want to come by. And Rick from Qualmark was like, you know what? I'll buy sandwiches if you put up a Qualmark banner. And we're like, okay.
So we probably have Qualmark chambers that you're going to demo or show.
Exactly. Yeah. The partnership is there and deep. I mean, that lab actually was originally started by Qualmark decades ago, like over 20 years ago. And then Brian bought it, but it's still all Qualmark equipment. And we all like working with each other. And
it sounds like the same story of Mike Silverman in his lab in Santa Clara. It used to be a Qualmark lab. And I don't know whether Mike bought it or what the story was, but he was owning and managing it, and they would do. So maybe Mike wasn't buying that lunch. Maybe Qualmark bought that lunch.
The first one we did, we were expecting a few people to show up, and it ended up being standing room only. And all we had planned was me to do three talks and then goofing around the lab. So it was like this one man show. I was like, oh God. So then we did it again, like a year or two later. You know, we just kind of like, whenever we think of it, we're like, hey, do you want to do this? And same thing again. And this time I did like five talks, and then Brian talked for a while, and we just kind of whatever. And then we're talking about doing it again this year, and I kind of like forgot about it with so much going, not forgot about it, but I had the book going and started an education company too. And I was like, ugh, what am I going to fit this in? And late in the summer, I was like, hey, Brian, you want to try and squeeze this in? And we were talking about it. He's like, yeah. And it just like exploded. Qualmark, you know, was into it, and now they're SPEC Qualmark. And then Air Liquide wanted to get in on it. And then another company that does, you know, vacuum jacket manifolding. And then they wanted to speak also. So we had two other speakers now. And then a testing house I use here that does medical product design and testing, Northeast Biomed, they wanted – a friend of mine there wanted to talk too. So all of a sudden we had four speakers, seven sessions.
Oh, man, you're going to need a conference room next time, you know, or a conference center. Multiple tracks and all that good stuff.
Yeah, but with a conference center, I have to try and drag Halt chambers to a conference center. So that's not going to – I think if I take away the fun part of playing in the lab, people will come just to talk. Who wants – everybody can, you know.
Well, they'll come for the food too. There's that.
So it was fantastic, you know, and now people actually got on airplanes to come to it too, you know. Wow. Some of the representatives and one or two other. So it just was like, oh, my God, what's happening? So I videoed some of the sessions. And, I'm just going to throw them up there online. And
meanwhile, you're going to be working on excellent blog posts, right?
That's right. That's right.
Okay, good.
I know my blog posting, if anybody follows me, has been pretty delinquent because the book writing has replaced that. And by the time you're done writing book stuff, I'm just like, I can't even like, I'm like, ugh, I don't want to write a blog post, but I should.
That's right. You should. That's why I'm poking you there.
I know.
Oh, that's cool. Well, congratulations on a cool event. Sounds like you got something started. It'll be the 47th anniversary edition of the seminar at some point.
Yeah. I'll be 90 years old, dragging myself in there like, all right, everybody.
Let's go break stuff.
Let's go break stuff.
Exactly. So what did you break?
So we put in some different things, kind of very singular, like not even like complex products. We just wanted to show like kind of the common challenges and setup that happen. Mm-hmm. So like if you take a large PCB board and if you clamp it this way versus that way, like, and then you see deflection happening in this one area, would you want to brace that or not? You know, kind of just all that, like that strategy stuff that comes from doing 1,000 tests.
Right.
Which John Schoolcraft, who is our test engineer, has actually, he crossed like doing 1,000 tests like 3 years ago. So who knows what he's at now.
Oh, yeah.
But it's all those things about with the Hall test, as you're doing the test, you're changing what you're doing. I mean, and you're figuring out, okay, wait, this is of interest. I want to try to isolate here. I want to get more stress here. I want to take stress away from here so I can see what happens over here.
Yeah.
And so just that kind of thing. So very simple, but what comes from the simple is you get to see the, you know, the specific things that you want to observe, and then they'll drive you to do it differently.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's, like you said, it comes from experience, knowing how to do all of these different manipulations to the stresses.
Yeah.
And so that's worth getting on a plane for. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Now, one of the questions I got for you though is, it was a question I got in a local seminar here I did, and it was to a group of startup people. And I think I talked about these guys before, but one of the questions that came up was, I was talking about you do testing to provide feedback to the design. And they're like, wait a minute, I thought we did testing so to show the customers that it passes. And No, I mean, we do halt, right? To break stuff, that's mm-hmm. to uncover weaknesses, right? But in general, when we go off and do reliability testing, where do you land on that? I mean, I know there's a balance there somewhere, but I'm loath to go spend money in the lab unless there's a clear purpose for it.
Right. So this is what I call the, you know, test, you know, are you testing to pass or testing to improve, right? Mm-hmm. And reliability really falls in the test to improve, and quality testing is the test to pass, right? And that is a problem to get people to understand that mindset difference, because in a lot of reliability tests, if you test it and you get no failures, that means you probably had a bad test, right? Your test really didn't tell you much about the product.
Yeah, there's nothing, you lose that ability to improve if you just pass.
It's highly suspect.
Yeah, or it's just a poorly designed test.
Right.
I mean, we've been there a few times, but it's there. I mean,
but then the other part of it is, so then if you get into the other, you know, part with reliability testing, to me falls in one of two, somewhere on a linear line, where at one end is you're testing to measure and the other end you're testing to improve, and reliability tests are some percentage combination of all that. Mm-hmm. Right. So Hall testing is very much at one end. It's entirely on the test to improve. It gives up the opportunity to really measure anything so that you can get a ton of data to help you improve the design very quickly.
But it answers the one of our fundamental questions, at least the way I think of it, is it's what's going to fail. It answers, it goes particularly well at finding out, well, what's going to fail, right? It's, but you're right. It doesn't tell you when it's going to fail necessarily.
Right. So that's the compromise the thing is that, as you said, you want to know the intent, and there's a very broad set of tools in the reliability toolbox. I mean, it's really a ton. So like any good, you know, technical person, you know what tool to pull out at the right time. Mm-hmm. And so you have to know what's the question you're asking. If you're trying to measure reliability performance and you pull out Hall testing, you obviously don't know what you're doing. If you have a new design prototype and you're not looking for statistical significance of behavior, you're like, hey, how does this thing break? I don't even know. And I want to give the design engineers some input right now while it's easy to change the design.
Yep.
Hall testing's the test to pull off the shelf, right?
Yep.
So you have to be very clear on your intent for the test. And this is why I say some of the worst programs have the biggest and most thorough reliability program plans. Because if you take a reliability program plan that's just some standard one, you know, it's going to not serve you well, because it's just giving you prescriptive things to do that aren't based on what you're trying to do at that point in your program.
Or even worse, and I'm sure you've seen it, is where they have 47 different activities they need to accomplish in the 6 weeks they're allotted with the three samples they have. And so they do none of them well. Right. I'm exaggerating a bit.
But not by much. You're not exaggerating. Yeah. It's that conversation all the time.
You know, but I think when you pull back and you look at the end of this activity or experiment, what am I trying to accomplish? Who do I need to provide information to? And what's the criteria of that information? What do they need to make the right decision?
Right. And so that's the value of a reliability engineer, is they are able to do that translation for you. What is your question? What are you trying to do? Hmm. And then the reliability engineer says, this is what you need to do to
maybe
get
I
an
need
answer.
Maybe I should hire a reliability engineer to help me out.
Right, exactly. Which is the thing with this, you know, is that when companies want to, I've had lots of companies say, hey, can you create a, you know, reliability program plan we can put in our process, and then we'll do all programs.
We'll do all
for this.
That, yeah.
Yeah, they're thinking it's this guideline thing that they can do, and it's a pass-fail thing, and it passes it, and you're good, and you don't need reliability team or reliability engineers or design for reliability. And, you know, they're thinking more in a quality sense of where you have a test you've developed that, you know, gives you a pass-fail. But then for quality, all the work is done up front in the research to figure out what that test should be. It's a different objective.
Well, I don't want to disparage our colleagues in the quality world, but the teams I've typically run across in product development areas primarily is they'll look at the product requirements. It's got to be blue, and what shade of blue, and how do you measure that, and how much does it weigh, and how fast does it go, and, you know, all of its functions. And they often then design tests to say, does it do that or not? And how much, and if they're better at it, they go, well, how much variability is there? And how can we minimize that variability so that we are consistently meeting what we say we're going to do? The hard part I find is that when they come across the reliability requirement, right, it's 98% will survive for 2 years. They kind of go, we don't know how to measure that. And so then guys like us come in and go, well, this is how you do it. And there's a range of techniques for it, but there's not one standard test to do that works in any circumstance, in every circumstance. Mm-hmm.
So, and that's frustrating to people, and I have to deal with that frustration and help get people through it, because they don't understand why you're not giving them a clean cut answer. And they're kind of like, why does he seem like he's dancing around the answer? Why, you know, am I getting snowed here? And it's then the whole education process for them to understand why a clear answer would be a false answer, because you're getting the information regarding the test and what the outcome is going to be and what it takes to get the outcome as you're doing the test.
Yeah. Now, I've had this discussion they had, I don't know, 15 or so qual tests that they used to prove to themselves that their product was ready to launch, essentially. And they did all these different things, drop testing and all kinds of weird stuff. And then they decided to keep doing that every month to monitor production. Kind of, it wasn't technically in my mind an ongoing reliability test, but they just decided to spend all this money and requalify their product every month, which I thought was crazy. So after I tracked down all this data that they had from years of production of testing every month, and showed that 14 out of the 15 tests were an absolute waste of time. Your product was so good, it wasn't even close to ever failing in any of these realms. But this one failed periodically, and notice your warranty payments a month or 2 months later spiked, right? And they did horrible failure analysis work on their field data, so they didn't know what those spikes were from. And by the time that anybody paid attention to it, it went away, and then they went back to work and did nothing about it. And I was like, you were monitoring the right thing by chance and didn't pay attention to it and didn't,
right,
you know, all these things that you weren't doing right. But that was the worst case of setting up a test, calling it reliability, paying $250,000 a year for samples, and then another $500,000 for testing and technicians and test time and data reporting and all this stuff. And then nobody looked at it. You know, so I was going through the process of working with this product team going, all right, well, what testing do you do? And then just simply asking why, where's that used? Mm-hmm. When do you use that? How do you use that? What's the criteria for a good experiment or not? And it was deer in the headlight. Hey, we're too busy for that. We just set up the test.
Right. Okay. Right. Right.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
So how do you, so there's a lot of different people who ask the questions. And when project managers ask the question, they just want a date that you will tell them they have a 90% confidence and they want to know today how many units they should order.
Oh, that's easy. 6,000 units, easy. In three, right. 6,000 in three. And it'll take right. us 4 years.
Right, right. Yep. Exactly. Period. But what do you do to, well, first of all, then as if there's a reliability engineer in that conversation and at that in that team, what's the answer you give them to regarding that? And then what is the answer you give the project manager?
Well, in either case, is what do you need to know by when so you can make a good decision, right?
Okay, you know, I'm going to be right. But okay, so here's the thing though. I'm going to tell you that if you ask me to order more than 100 units, it's going to be tough.
Right.
And
right. And it's a trade-off, right? It's right. a trade-off. It's do you want to know it precisely? Will you wait till all your customers use it to failure and then we know? If you want to know before we give it to customers, there's a risk, right? We're making a sample and we're projecting into the future. But we need to know the failure mechanisms so we can design the right tests to do this. So here's maybe it's HALT or FMEA or field data from similar products, and then move on. We can quickly create a plan, but it's always a balance of risk. How well do you need to know it before you're comfortable? And if you use like the 90% confidence on that, it subsumes basically that you're going to have so many samples. And you do the math and you come back to him and go, well, you can't have that many. Well, then what are you going to give up? You want less reliability or less confidence or both?
Would you do the calculation just trying to put it? See, the problem is Weibull's going to give you the best information in the end because it characterizes the true behavior. But the problem is with Weibull, it's not till you begin to characterize the behavior that you can give any indication of a relationship between samples and confidence.
Yeah, sometimes it's just a guess. You just use a beta of two. Or if you understand the underlying failure mechanism, if it's a wear out type mechanism, then you pick a Weibull of two or three or based on field data. Or if you really just don't know at all, be conservative. Pick just use exponential, right? It's going to give you a higher number of samples and in longer test time. The more information you have, the more accurate you can be in your estimates. It's a catch-22, right? When you create something new, you don't even know how it's going to fail, so it's really hard to predict. So I usually start with some ridiculous huge number and then enter into that conversation of it's a trade-off. You can't have everything, right? Because you're not going to give me enough time, resources, or samples. So what's most important to you? And usually it comes down to, I want to make sure this doesn't burn their house down. So let's make sure that the critical elements that create catastrophic failures are designed out of the product. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, it's not a crystal reliability metric that I can go say, yeah, we got it all. But you can do due diligence on that, right? If they say, no, I need to know it's 98% reliable in 2 years, well, then here are a range of ways we can go about doing this. What's the trade-offs? And then to have that discussion. And if all hell breaks loose, I just pull out some integrals for some reliability distributions and confuse the daylights out of them and get my resume together.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly. So binomials usually attractive to people because it seems so clean cut and simple and requires lower sample size. When would you say that's appropriate to use? When would you be comfortable saying, fine, if you want to do that, these are the conditions that I would consider that acceptable?
Yeah. One, you're giving up the ability to learn anything other than, right? You will always have the risk. Independent from the confidence calculation, the statistics and the sampling calculations, is that your test is pretty meaningless, right? If we use heat.
So just to clarify for our listeners, the reason being that if you observe any failure in a binomial-based test, you can't say anything.
Well, on a success-based test, if you go with the minimum sample size and accept at zero failures only,
right?
You can create a test that has, you know, you can have three or four failures and you fail it at when you have an extra failure for that. And there's a couple of different algorithms going about that, still using the binomial that gives you a little better protection on the type two error, the producer's error. It's a little more precise, but it generally takes a lot more samples. So it's the success testing is the one where you take, say, 22 samples and run them for the equivalent of a lifetime of stress. And if none of them fail, you have a result. If one of them fails, the only thing you can really do is keep running until you get enough failures to fit a distribution to it. And then it's open-ended. You don't know how long that's going to take. And then you're really screwed if you get two different failure mechanisms, two completely different ones. Now you got competing things. So anyway, it gets complicated quick. And so the hard part is that it's not like in quality, right? It's blue and it's this shade or it's this close to that shade, which is deemed acceptable. It's not black and white. Reliability, depending on how you accelerate it or activate it or use it, right? Different sets of failure mechanisms come into play. So if I want to know how long the paint on my car lasts, right, I could just park it outside. But if I park it outside in a hot, humid environment with lots of blowing dust, right, it's a very different environment than the freeze-thaw conditions in some parts of the world. And different paints will respond differently to those. So it's almost always these discussions, what's the intent of this testing besides who's going to use it for what is back to what's the failure mechanism? What am I trying to invest when we're trying to measure reliability? It's either let's discover the failure mechanism or now that we know a failure mechanism, how do we measure it for its duration, for its time to failure pattern? But most of the time, those discussions usually, most people I've talked to, whether project managers or not, understand it's planning and it's going to change as we learn more things. And the more you build in those milestones and decision points to adjust your plan to get you the best possible information, I think the better your testing will be because it will be continually nudged towards getting what you need to know based on the information you have.
Yep.
Yeah, I could go with that.
All right.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense to me. The problem is getting other people to think it makes sense. So it's interesting always going back and forth with the people who want to plan the future. And I totally understand their position too. Mm-hmm. You know, having them understand that it's as you're learning as you go to tell you what's going to happen next or changes what you decide to do.
Yep.
Because you can have anything from a data point that's an outlier. And you can go one of two directions with that. You can root cause it and say, okay, this is a weird quality defect that we know won't happen in production, and you take it out of the data set. Or you can say, I don't understand what happened here. We need to do a lot more testing to see if this is something or not. You know, and you just double the length of your program. Yep. And that stuff happens all the time. But usually the way I end up saying it is like, if you want to do it quick, you have to go into it's like going into a casino and putting all your chips on one square. Mm-hmm. And you're all in, you know, and you better go in with insane confidence that everything's going to come out great and your product's amazing and it's not going to have the slightest issue. And
well, there's that's a topic for a whole nother discussion, is that attitude.
Right. Well, but yeah. I mean, I say to them to help them understand that if they want to go with a simple binomial, no failure, that's what you're saying, basically. And the reality is that never happens in a product development program. So beware that you've gone all your chips on one spot and in one single failure, you lose everything. You know.
Right. Well, you lose that information. Now you lose what you were trying to achieve.
Right.
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, so if, you know, you're listening to this make a note of the URL for it so you can send it to people you want to help convince, you know, give them a little pre-work before you go into the discussion of, you know, setting up your plan and what testing you're going to do. And it's, you know, if you've got stories about absolutely perfect discussions that ended up in getting the right tests and really clear intents and so on, or the opposite. We'd love to hear from you on that. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can find a contact form and ways to get in touch with us. Both Adam and I are on LinkedIn. We also have our emails up on the site, so you can certainly get in touch with us, and we'd love to hear from you. You know, Adam, a lot of these questions either come from our discussions with customers or at seminars or forums, but it's been lately about 25% of the topics in the show have been from people responding and saying, hey, I got this question or this follow-up or this idea. And so those things, I think, are a great way for you to join the conversation. So we certainly appreciate it. All right. I guess we'll wrap it up there. Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, it's a good chat.
Let's go break some more stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.